Being trained in an effective crisis management system is imperative for minimizing behavioral issues and the need for restraint in schools and treatment facilities. But not all crisis management systems were created equal. If we are going to meet the growing intense behavioral needs of individuals while simultaneously reducing the need for restraints, every leader and policymaker who is involved in areas related to behavioral challenges should understand what a complete crisis management system is comprised of and how to embed one into any setting. For more information, check out crisisintervention.com. Welcome to the Crisis in Education podcast, where behavior science meets education. I'm your host, Dr. Pauly, exploring avenues for change and growth alongside my guests. Join us as we work towards turning crises into opportunities. Okay, welcome back to the Crisis in Education podcast. I'm very happy to have a former coachee of mine on and finding out some pretty cool stuff that she's moved on up in the world. And I remember coaching her and thinking, man, this is a special one because she just absorbed so much knowledge and then would put it right into application. It was really very cool to see. So doesn't that surprise me? Welcome to the show, Jillian Bucciero, right? I'm going to make sure I'm not.
Bucciero.
All right. Damn it. Let's see what happens with a few years. It's been a couple of years. How long has it been since we used to have our sessions? Maybe 2 or 3 years ago? I can't remember how long.
Yep, I think about 3 years ago. So
yeah.
It's great to be able to be talking with you again.
Well, thank you. I mean, since that time, I forget, what position were you in back when we were working together?
I was the education coordinator, and now I am the assistant director.
Very, very, very cool. And I know it was in alternative schools with kids for kids with emotional disabilities. And I remember you were really, you know, really working on putting in some good OBM practices at the school and moving things in a different direction. You had to rally the troops, you know, involve your stakeholders. You're looking for quick wins, rebuilding the system, involving the people. It was really interesting to watch and seeing it grow. So, tell me a little bit how you went from where you were to where you are now. And then let's get into this topic because we're going to discuss feedback. And man, feedback is so incredibly important in everything we do. There's no learning without feedback, but it's fundamentally probably the most important thing that a leader can do. Ensure that either they're giving feedback or there's feedback loops built into the system. So I'm looking forward to talking about that. But how'd you go from where you were last time I chatted with you to where you are now?
Absolutely. And this topic is so important to me because I think feedback is exactly how I continue to grow. So originally, I started as a special education teacher, and I never saw myself going into school administration. I always thought I would be a teacher for 10 to 20 years, get a PhD, and then do research. And I actually ended up in administration by accident. I had applied for a teaching position, and the director, you know, came to me and said, hey, I have this other position of being an education coordinator. You would need to go get your administrator certification, but I want you for this role. So I took a chance on it and I fell in love with school administration. And I just continued to really grow in it thanks to mentorship and feedback. You were a fantastic mentor and you taught me so many skills, which really helped me progress. And the director really took me under his wing and was a fantastic mentor to me and really increased my skills over the years. So I just continued to grow in my capacity within the organization.
It really was. I mean, you were also a fantastic coachee because, or mentee, however you want to call it, because you would actively seek out feedback. And, so you would recruit feedback from me. You would recruit from your own environment. I think you were also always looking to the impact of your own behavior because they're like anything, but especially in schools, there are challenges out there and there are a lot of histories we have to contend with, people who come in with varying level of skills. And so there are a number of challenges that have to be navigated. So I'm really, really happy to hear that you've been able to elevate yourself that way and taking this whole approach and I'm sure elevating lots of others. So, tell me a little bit about, why you wanted to focus on feedback today. I mean, I know we just talked about the importance of it, but like, why is it in the front of your mind? There's a lot of things to talk about, and I love talking about feedback, though. This is great.
Well, I think I have spent a lot of time on getting better at giving feedback. And I know that it's an area that a lot of leaders struggle with. We all feel very uncomfortable, but it is so important to education. In education, people really are our capital. I think if you look at the research, principals can, accelerate achievements if they're effective by like 3 months worth of learning, and a teacher being really effective can accelerate student learning by, I think, almost a year's worth of learning if they're really effective. And the only way people get effective is with feedback and coaching.
Yeah, I agree. It's fundamental to, coaching is a very part. I have a in my new book. I know we talked about. I have like four hats of leadership. There's leading, training, coaching, and managing. What I find is that too often leading is missing and the coaching is missing. Like people send people to training and then they go jump right to managing. And coaching is about supporting the generalization of learned skills into the natural environment. And this is often missing. And as we both know that, the research says this that. Great trainings are great, but people are going to go right back into the natural environment. They're not going to engage in the behaviors they've been trained in, unfortunately. Before we get into good feedback, can you talk about whether it was with yourself or what you learned? What are the issues that you've seen with feedback? Because we want to talk about so that's we talk about the importance of feedback, but why is it a problem? Why has it been problematic? And then we can talk about what people need to know to help their feedback become better.
Sure. I think feedback ends up really problematic, often when the person giving the feedback doesn't first seek to understand and collect all of the information. And they might be giving feedback without really having a full understanding of the scope. And they
Okay.
might not be knowledgeable. And then they might go in with a way that's kind of abrasive or negative or self-righteous. And it puts the person receiving feedback on the defensive immediately. And once they're on that defensive, they can't hear your feedback and internalize it and work on that.
I've seen that so much, right? It's not about intent, it's about impact. I've seen people, and I know we're going to talk about it. I don't want to give away any of the good stuff. I'll save that for you. But man, I've seen a lot of people going out there and giving feedback, and they're actually tearing it in the name of student achievement, end up hurting student achievement. They end up hurting teacher performance. They end up making their job a whole lot more challenging because they don't understand the nuances of feedback and the environment in which, that needs to be provided. Feedback is. I mean, it really is everything. But no, I like to. I mean, there's so many great analogies for how we need to have feedback. I think you and I used to talk about like the GPS and like, for example, timing of feedback is important. Imagine going somewhere and you don't know where the heck you are, and you're in a city, and the GPS is only popping on every 15 minutes. Like, man, you're gonna get frustrated with that because it's not helping you learn the way to get there, and you end up learning through a bunch of trial and error. And we don't want our teachers learning through trial and error. We wouldn't mind our students doing it, but if it's something that we've contriving the activity for them to learn, they can better assess, problem solve, make decision, take action. But that's still not really trial and error. It's a contrived situation that's helping them along the way. So can you give the listeners a couple examples of when you've actually seen, or maybe you've done it yourself. I've done lots of not great things, but you've seen. Maybe something that people can relate to, the misdelivery, the unintentional poor delivery of feedback. And just a couple of examples of that. I've got plenty.
Yeah, so I think when I originally started in my educational leadership journey, I had plenty of missed deliveries on of feedback. I remember I was going to be giving te a teacher feedback on some classroom management and a potential strategy. Her students argued with her about directions, and I wanted to provide her feedback on, providing an explicit instruction lesson to teach this social skill. And I was very uncomfortable, but very confident in my idea. And I think I kind of hid behind the computer and I put the feedback in an email and I just jotted out my recommendation without talking to this teacher in person. I think it can be uncomfortable, and in an email, you might not have to face kind of having to talk to somebody. So I think that was one of the biggest mistakes I made. It went over horribly. She was so upset. She was mad. She felt like I was not being supportive. And, you know, so much of that would have been avoided had I went and I talked to her and I listened to her before just jotting out a couple of bullet points in an email and sending it off.
Boy, do we have the similar experience. I did the same thing. And talking about being punished for that, same thing. I was actually getting ready to, I remember so clearly, it's like 2007. And I, for the same thing, it was classroom management. And I was asked to go into a classroom that I'd never seen. And which now I know better, like, don't, I'm not going to go in and give any sit back in the class unless I've met with the teacher and Bob, we'll talk about that stuff later on. But I went back in the back and I took notes in there and, sent her a list of things that, you know, could have been better. Man, I remember exactly what she said. Your rhetoric falls on deaf ears. And yeah, she didn't like me very much after that. And I don't blame her. You know, can you imagine somebody coming and watching you, you know, do something and pointing out everything that you're doing wrong or whatever, even if you word it nicely, which I did, you know what I mean? I didn't hammer anything like that. And not people not having any input and yada, yada. So, you know, I think the lesson there is like, man, do not deliver corrective feedback through an email. Have conversations with it. That's one important lesson there. Don't do that. And people do it. I think that they're not well-meaning. They get so busy that they're like, I need to get this feedback out. But what does it matter if it's not going to have the intended impact? In fact, it's going to make things much harder for you. So you're best to have a way to provide, deliberately provide feedback with people. And of course, there's got to be, I think, certain environmental factors in place, you know? So, all right. So that's a great example. Now, but taking off you a little bit, have you seen anybody else? Have you experienced somebody giving you poor feedback about something? And how did that make you feel?
You know, I've definitely gotten the poor feedback. I think in a very similar situation where not having the relationship and not really understanding a situation, I remember, I think it was my first year as a teacher, and we had a BCBA coming in because I started out as an autism teacher. And I think in one of our first interactions, she was going to be giving me feedback. And she started off by saying, you know, my job is to teach you how to teach. And I was just like, whoa, this is our first interaction. And excuse me, I'm a teacher. You're the BCBA. And I remember I was just so offended immediately that I didn't hear anything else she said. And it really kind of, I shut down hearing anything she suggested for a couple of, I'm going to say probably like 2 months. And we were able to repair that relationship. And I ended up having a fantastic working relationship with her. And she was able to give me such good advice and feedback along the way. But I remember just that first statement put me off. I shut down and I didn't hear anything after that.
What a great example. How one interaction, right? I always use an example that says, you know, one lie can undo 1,000 truths. You know, one coercive interaction with somebody can undo 1,000 positive. I mean, it depends on the level of coercion, but that also depends on how strong a relationship and how much, you know, positive reinforcement has been put into that relationship bank. And you didn't have any of that at that moment. So I can imagine that. And so clearly the person was well-intended because you would never had a relationship with them afterwards. But that simple interaction with them, that simple statement, this is why it's so important. There's an art and science to delivering feedback. And the art meaning that, you know, you and I can say the same thing, but it sounds different. It looks different. You know what I mean? But there's a scientific approach to it. Like, we all don't have to sound like me. We don't have to sound like you. I've seen amazing teachers that look like, you know, the elementary kind of ish teachers, you know, that are like bubbly and blah, blah. I've seen them get like, man, like juvenile kids with lots of behavioral challenge in alternative schools, like get them right in line. They were very sweet. And I've seen like somebody that's very stoic, just kind of look at them and be like, sit down. And they sit down. You know what I mean? It's crazy. And of course, it's built on their history. So that's the art of it. But there is a science behind it that's led up to that their interactions and how they've established themselves as reinforcement, how they've given feedback and how they've gotten them in touch with successful outcomes, all these pieces of the puzzle. So that's a great, I love that illustration that you gave, that example. All right. So let's make the shift now, because we've established that, you know, feedback is important. All learning requires feedback. Without feedback, there is absolutely no learning. Giving feedback can be, you know, it can be received poorly for a number of reasons. And we've covered like a couple of those reasons, like maybe not having a relationship with people or giving it in an email. Let's kind of move on to like what is behind delivering good feedback, right? What are the criteria that you need to have somebody successfully provide feedback?
Absolutely. So I think we kind of touched on what I would consider the first building block of effective feedback, which is building trust. You know, without that trust, you really can't deliver feedback. I think in education, you know, you hear a lot when people say relations are the most important thing. I think that statement is slightly misleading and inaccurate. For example, if a teacher has really great relationships with her students, but they don't learn to read or write, like that's not enough. The relationship isn't the most important thing. We need to make sure kids, we deliver on the skills we promise children. However, if you picture it more like a pyramid, that academic achievement is at the top, but relationships are kind of a foundational building block up to it. You're probably not going to get to that academic achievement without those relationships. And I think that very much easily slides over into like a principal-teacher relationship.
100%. It's so ironic that everything fundamentally, principle-wise, everything we ask the teachers to do with the students, as principals, administrators, we should be doing with the teachers. Like everything. We want them to have a good classroom management system that's built on relationships, that sets expectations where they observe and they give reinforcement and correction, but they also ask good questions in their teaching, right? That's exactly what administrators should be doing, right? So it all becomes the same thing because the principles of behavior are the same. They're all connected up. I love that you talked about relationships being fundamental. I believe in that, right? But it's not. It's the end. The result we're trying to get is achievement, but you can't get that. You can't get student achievement without this piece of the puzzle in place because people need to feel comfortable. They need to feel like that's your point, that they can trust you in there. And if you've ever worked in a place where you feel afraid, this is not optimal for learning. That's not a great environment. Your administrator is not going to get the best out of you if they're helping you feel afraid. So this is what we want for the teachers with the students to have good relationships, but the same thing with the administrators. And this stuff that I hear all the time, I'm sure we talked about this a while back, Jillian, that, do it for the kids. You can't make it about the kids without making it about the adults. End of story. That's a cop-out to me. And I'm not saying people do it purposely as a cop-out. But if you think about it, that's kind of blaming the teachers if they're not getting success, right? All right. So fundamentally, we have to have relationships. Good. Let's talk about what does that look like? Because everybody talks about that. Yeah. How do we build relationships with people?
I think it's very similar to the way we talk about teachers building relationship with their kids. You want to make sure you're having at least that magic ratio of 5 positive interactions to every 1 negative interaction. So just smiling, saying hi, asking about their families. I think that's really important to get to know your team's goals and values, because that's also going to play a role later when you're giving them feedback. So understand what's important to them. What do they feel most proud of in their teaching? What do they have, do they have kids at home, or do they really like to talk about their son who's a fantastic basketball player? So just taking that time to have those conversations with them will make a massive impact.
I love that. And simple, right? Going back to the fundamental stuff, like treat people like people. Like I do something where I'm out when I'm giving a training and I talk about this piece of the puzzle and I say, imagine if I was an administrator and you were standing in the hallway and I walk around the audience, right? And I don't say a word to them. I just walk by them and I got like a stern face on my look. I'm like, how would you feel about me? It's our body is like a transmitter. We're constantly putting out signals. What are people experiencing from my presence? I was giving a training one day and I thought it was going very well. It was in I write about this in one of my books. I don't remember which one, but I was in the library and people were laughing, enjoying themselves. And all of a sudden it got very quiet. I'm like, oh man, what did I say? I thought I must have said something like bad because it got like, and I looked up and it's like cue the Darth Vader music. It wasn't me. It was that the principal had walked into that room. And think about that. That principal's presence had this impact on these teachers is a terrible thing to me. It made me feel sick for them to experience that. Cause I don't want to experience that from somebody, right? Imagine students feeling that way every time they see the teacher, or teachers feeling it every time they see their school leader. Or I've seen school leaders that were going to, high paid consultants that were just brutalizing them with their approach to training them. Like they'd be out in the cars crying, their cars crying before they went into this training. It was horrible. I remember I was so mad at that person. I'm not even going to say it, but I remember erasing his board when he's telling them to do wrong stuff. I'm like, this is not scientific. This is the way you do stuff, man. Anyways, so we got to build relationships with people. We got to interact with them in a positive way. And it's just being nice to people, ask them questions, doing that stuff. That doesn't mean, you know, that is fundamental. That doesn't mean we don't correct performance. I know we're going to get to that piece of the puzzle. All right. So relationships, fundamental. Now what?
All right. I think, you know, the next part of it, which is going to make feedback easier, and I think really ties into all the things we've talked about with organizational behavior management, is having sets of norms and expectations. And I think you want to think of this in two silos. You want to have your expectations for kind of how we teach and do the work. And then we also want to have a set of expectations for how we interact with each other as team members. So I think if you're going to be giving feedback on instruction, it really helps if your school has a cohesive, you know, framework for teaching and learning that you're going to be able to referring back to.
Now, so I love this, right? So people need to know what they're supposed to do. And some of the simplest issues happen because people don't know the expectations. We just assume they know. The same way we want the teachers to establish the expectations with the students. And I say involve them when we're making the expectations, your classroom management system, all this stuff, right? Get their input on it. People need to know those expectations. And one of the things, as I'm thinking about this, one of the things people think about feedback, and you've already covered this, but I want to pull this back out, is that people think feedback is about correcting performance or behavior, right? And it's both ways. You already said, use the 5-to-1 ratio, right? Make sure you are recognizing what's going well, you know, or interacting 5 times as much as when you correct it. Because when you do that, they're going to be much more likely, especially if you've built a good relationship and the feedback's been sincere and you've interacted with them on a lot of positive things, they're going to accept that because they know you are there to help them with it. But if all you're doing is correcting behavior, nobody wants to be around somebody like that. You know, no, it's a horrible place to be. So, all right. I think, okay, establishing very clear expectation. I like what you said. It wasn't just expectations for how they're going to be teaching. It's also expectations how they're interacting with each other. And I love that you brought that to attention, because we got to be in a culture, and culture shared behavior. And we need to know, and that behavior should be grounded in solid values. And a lot of times their values are just writing on the wall. So I think the values, let's say, you know, we have a, you know, we say we want to respect. You know, we respect is a value of ours. Well, what does that look like behaviorally? What's that look like when you're working with the students? What's it look like when you're interacting with each other? What does it look like when I, as an administrator, interact with you, right? So unpacking that stuff behaviorally, that's great that you're making that generalization there. Cool.
Absolutely. And I think you talked to a fantastic point. What I see a lot of times in schools is they might just have that generic value, or they'll create a school charter where they talk about how they want to feel, but then they don't get into what are the behaviors that create those feelings. And, you know, the organization that I've worked for, they have what they call their 10 leadership behaviors that I fell in love
They're
with.
Nice.
You know, I think I've kind of, in my own mind, I've kind of refined them and adopted them and maybe added some to kind of really define my own leadership behaviors. And I know that no matter where I go, I'm going to take those with me. And it's the standard I hold myself to. And I share it with my team, and it's the standard I hold them to. I, you know, wherever I am, those leadership behaviors, we have posters on the wall. And so I can kind of share.
I love this, because what you're saying to me is, and I'd like to hear a couple of those behaviors. This is the reason, folks, that Jillian is taking them with her, because she kind of put it, you can't see this, but she put her hand on her heart, you know, these are her values. Values are a way of being and doing. They're not just words, right? They're this. And values are our guide to, you know, achieving the school's mission, you know, towards moving towards a vision. And we always got to check our behaviors against our stated values, because they're just stated values, right? Are we behaving in alignment with the things that we say are important to us? And of course, we want shared values with people. We want to find out, we want to hire people that have shared values. We want them to be in the mix. And a lot of people do have the shared values, and they just tend to, you know, things happen and they end up engaging in behaviors that are momentarily misaligned with their values. And we need to help people be aware of those. And that's why I think, you know, having good process in place will that allow for those regular checks. Jillian, I think we looked at the ACT matrix a while back. You know, I love using that and everything that I do. Maybe we'll talk about that in a little bit, but tell me some of those behaviors that you're talking about.
Absolutely. So I'll give you the overview and then we can probably jump into a few of them. So model high expectations, be accountable, be humble, be curious, be humanistic, and leverage separate realities, assume positive intent, and add value.
Let's take a quick break.
If you work across schools or treatment facilities and you want an environment characterized by students or clients behaving well and meeting their goals, you need Everyday Behavior Tools. These tools are so powerful and generalizable that you can train anybody, anywhere in them. And here is the best part. The entire instructor training is online. If you are interested in becoming an Everyday Behavior Tools trainer to improve behavior in your organization while also generating more income for yourself, go to crisisintervention.com. Oh, okay. All right. Assume positive. All right. So this is very good. Now, we talk about that. So explain that to me, assume positive intent, right? Intent. What would people would, I think, need to know what that looks like. Tell me what that looks like to you.
Absolutely. So, you know, when you assume positive intent, maybe somebody kind of, you're leading a staff meeting and one of your employees, you think they kind of like huffed and rolled their eyes, you know, or maybe they look really angry and frustrated today. You know, we, I think, as people like to create stories in our heads. We attach stories to people's behavior all of the time based off of just a little bit of information. So in that story in your head, you can either assume, well, this person's disrespectful. They don't care about what you're trying to say. And, you know, they're just rude in your meeting. Or you can assume positive intent and say, geez, wow, I wonder if something's going on at home. Geez, I wonder if they didn't notice that they did that. Or, you know, that might not have anything to do with me. Is the story you're creating in your head the best possible interpretation of the behavior that you're seeing?
And by the way, folks, we're talking about, well, that's not behavior. It is. It's covert behavior. It's behavior that only you can see, and you have to be aware of your behavior. Because if you have these thoughts, these can be antecedents to behaviors that are not aligned with your behavior. So if you don't assume, to Jillian's point, positive intent, you might jump on somebody. You might say, well, you're not doing this. And like, hey, they might have just been, you know, and I think intent is important. In the end, it's about impact, right? But if people are trying to do the right thing and you come out there and punish them, there's a reason they're doing it. It's a skill deficit or performance deficit. There's things like maybe they didn't know the expectations, or they just didn't have the skill to do it, or they're not seeing the impact of their behavior on the environment, right? They're unaware of that and a number of other things. So I think that is really important. I love that. That's an important one. I think that's a value to take across personal and professional lives.
And, you know, I love that you said, you know, thoughts are behavior, because they are. And our thoughts absolutely have the power to influence our, you know, outward behavior. You're going to approach a situation based off of the story that you're telling in your head. If you assume somebody's disrespectful, you're much more likely to go at them in an aggressive manner. Whereas if you're assuming positive intent, you're going to be much more likely to listen and ask questions.
I agree 100%. So, all right. I love this, man. Do you use the ACT matrix at all, or any of that? Like, how do you unpack this for people when you're out there? I mean, this is a value and sharing it with them. Like, how do you approach it with helping people to adopt these values if they're not aware of it?
Yeah. So I feel like I haven't used like the actual ACT matrix, but I talk to people and I kind of hear, you know, what their just natural values are. We all come with different cultures, beliefs, upbringings that really influence our values. And we might look at the ways these behaviors kind of align with those values.
Right. Okay. All right. Good. So I think that's a great activity. I use ACT matrix for people who aren't familiar with it. It's four boxes. Bottom right-hand corner is your values. Bottom left-hand corner, covert behaviors or thoughts and feelings that show up for you. Top left-hand corner are the behaviors that we engage in when we feel bad about something. And that allows you to check against, hey, if I these are escape motivated behaviors. You think about how good it feels to move away from anxiety. And sometimes we do some very healthy things like exercise, read a book, do deep breathing, whatever. But sometimes we're engaging in behaviors that are not aligned to our values. Like if we say we want a respectful, positive culture, but we yell at people when they don't perform well, or the teacher's yelling at the kids, it might feel good in the moment. It might work because people jump in line and do the right thing. But that's misaligned with their values, right? It's winning the battle but losing the war. In the top right-hand corner of that box is you know, it's like a, you know, that's like a self-functional behavior assessment on the left side. The right side is the replacement behaviors, right? It's like a self-behavior intervention plan. Or if we make the bottom right-hand corner shared values, that top right-hand corner becomes the group. It's like an OBM plan, right? What behaviors do we need to engage in that allow us to move towards these values? So I think it's, man, having values as the guide, as the underpinning to you know, the behaviors to the system that you have in your school or your district, because comes so important, man. I'd love to hear that that's embedded in there. Well done, Jillian. Okay,
Absolutely.
so what do we got next? This is
Let's, you
fun.
know, be accountable. I think that, you know, I think modeling, you know, the your expected behaviors, that's easy. But, you know, I think there's a good question that goes with be accountable that I think everybody should ask themselves in every situation, which is, how did I contribute to the current situation? Now, if that's a misunderstanding, if that was a missed opportunity, we want to ask ourselves, how did I contribute to that? So let's say that I'm a special education leader and one of my team members, you know, drops the ball on conducting an initial evaluation. First thing I'm going to do is, as a leader, I'm going to reflect and I'm going to ask, how did I potentially contribute to this situation? And so I'm going to ask, like, did maybe I not, you know, clearly communicate the expectations? Should have this maybe been on a shared calendar? And I'm going to own my part of that.
I can't tell you how much I love that. So, this is so the intentional search for the impact of your behavior is what sets good leaders from great leaders, right? Because people try to model some way. So, you're looking at what am I doing, and how could I have been different? It's like a self-performance diagnostic, right? Did I ensure expectations? Did I ensure that there's routines or the process in place? Am I giving feedback? How often am I giving feedback? Is it 4-to-1 or 5-to-1 feedback? You know, am I helping people see the impact of their behavior? And so doing a self-check, because too often people are just go out to point the fingers instead of looking at, you know, the impact of their behavior. I would also say that, and maybe you're going to get to this, but I'll go ahead and plug it in now,
Go for it.
that looking at the person you're supporting, their performance is feedback for you. Feedback doesn't have to be from people telling you something, right? Feedback comes from, like, what is the impact of my behavior? And if we can not take it personal, if we can keep on an objective scientific lens, be like, all right, whatever I'm doing right now is not having the intended impact on this performance. So we can't change somebody's genetics. We can't change their learning history, right? All we can do is arrange the environment in a different way that's going to get the best of them. So what do I need to do as a leader to bring out the best in them? So I got to do something more, less, or differently that's going to change and continue to do the same thing, or continue to give, you know, corrective feedback if that's not working, probably actually is hurting. Even if you might see some sort of immediate change, that's dangerous because it reinforces that leader's behavior. They see, well, this is the way you get change. But it's winning the battle but losing the war, as you and I both, we know very well.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, being curious, I think kind of ties into what we talked about earlier, how we as people create those stories in our heads, which will influence our behavior. So being curious means asking questions before you're creating those stories. So let's say Mr. Chris is late to work all week. Did you jump to conclusions and say, well, he's lazy, he's unprofessional, and he's disengaged, and now I'm going to go in and, you know, with a written warning and say, you need to be on time, or am I going to go in curious and say, hey, Mr. Chris, I noticed you were late all this week. Like, what's up with that? Is everything okay?
Right. That I love that. There's an example that I use, that is the same example about late. And I think about, imagine it. I've actually had this happen recently with somebody that I know. They come in early every day. They stay late every day, as well as other teachers. And the administrator, one day, they came in, like, I don't know, 13 minutes late, or it might have been 3 minutes late. I don't know, whatever it is. And they got reprimanded for being late. Yet, there was no question as why they were late. Had never been any recognition of all the times they came in early and all the times that they'd stayed in late. That is a morale buster, not just for that teacher, as you and I well know. Believe me, this teacher goes to the water booth, they're in the teacher planning area, and they're not thinking about the lesson plan. They're upset, they're hurt, and they're talking to other teachers, and that spreads like cancer, you know, and it's because of the leader's approach to it. So I think, you know, finding out information, treating people with compassion and respect doesn't mean that people should be coming in late. If it needs to be corrected, correct it. But have you done your work? Have you built your relationships? Did you get all the data right? Did you get them to reflect on, you know, what they did and the impact of what's going on in there? Is there an I'm sure there's an expectation for being on time, but do they understand the impact on the other teachers, right? Because we want that piece of the puzzle. So, yeah, that's a very good one. Very good one.
Absolutely. And I think that very much ties into being humanistic. You know, I think you talk so much about caring for people as people, and they are. People have lives outside, you know, they have things going on with their family, and making room for the fact that people have, that people are people.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Well, it is. They are people, man. We're not talking about numbers here. We need people to feel safe. I mean, I love, like, I know this isn't like a scientific basics behind this, but Maslow's hierarchy need, you talked about the triangle earlier, and there is, man, fundamentally people need to feel safe. They need to feel cared for. You know, there is research called stages of concern, that talks about teachers. If, you know, if you want them to perform successfully, fundamentally, there's got to be all these things in place, right? They got to have the tools to do it. They got to feel that they're being supported, et cetera, et cetera. And most teachers leaving the field are leaving. There's three things that they can to every time, most of the time. Number one is perceived lack of support from administration. Number two is feeling unprepared for the demands of the classroom. Number three are behavior challenges. Believe me, that they're all linked. You know, I mean, they're definitely linked there. So we got to think about them as people. What would we do if we're in their position? How would we feel about it? If this was our son or our daughter or friend or mother or father, whatever it is, we have to treat them as such. That doesn't mean we don't work on improving performance. Of course we do, but it's not just it's what we do, it's how we do it and when.
Absolutely. Then also leveraging separate realities. And I think that also speaks to that people come with their own histories, cultures, experience, values, and people's perception of a situation is their reality. And and it might be different than my perception of a situation. And making room for both of those realities to exist as we come together. For example, I come from a really loud Italian family. And when I get excited in any way, if I'm really happy about something or just passionate or upset, my voice gets louder and louder. My boss, who I have a great relationship with, and he can give me, I'm so comfortable with his feedback. He's constantly going shh, or giving me little hand motions to quiet down. But that's very, you know.
We have that relationship with him. They can do whatever. You can say, go sit your little butt down right now. And you're like, oh, my bad. You know, because when you have a relationship.
Absolutely. But, you know, I ran into an issue once where I had a team member who came from a very different culture, and kind of loud talking was seen as very disrespectful. And I remember when she said, you yelled at me. I didn't yell at you. There was no yelling involved. But I had to make room for that separate reality where her perception was that I did yell at her, even though my perception was that I didn't. So could I make room for that? Could I validate that? And then going back to that accountability, apologize and say, wow, I'm really sorry that you felt yelled at.
Yeah, it was my intent. It's my impact. And this is why we have to have things like a couple things. First, I don't want to forget this. I'm going to make a little note here. I come back to this. So number one, perception taking is critical. It's critical for many reasons. My guru, Aubrey Daniels, has something they call the picnic, right? And from the picnic, when we think about somebody's not performing to a standard, we got to put down their hat, right? They're doing something else. Why? What are the experiences as a result of it? You know, what are they getting from? Are they escaping something? Are they, you know, getting, is it immediate? Is the consequence delayed? You know, is it future? There's all these things to think about. Like, why is somebody not at their post? What are they, you know, why is somebody not teaching to a standard? And of course, that comes with the performance diagnostic checklist as well. So there's that. So understanding perception is very important. There's also to the piece more that's aligned with what you're saying is social validity and checking in with how people feel about the way things are going on around here. You know, are we getting the results that we want? And do we like the way that we're getting those results? And so you gave an example of just an interaction, but I think on a scale, we have to have some sort of social validity. We have to check in to see how people are doing. Nika, my colleague and I, my partner, work with an organization right now. And when I was an administrator also CEO of a clinic in a school, I had weekly check-ins, right? I had weekly data checking in to see how people were doing. And I'd need to act on that stuff. And when this stuff is grounded in values, right? Asking people, you know, we unpack those values, figuring out, you know, hey, do you feel supported? Are you getting this? Are you getting that? And we can look for patterns and we can respond to it. Now, organizations do have something like this, like called climate surveys or culture surveys. But unfortunately, Jillian, as you and I both well know, a lot of these things happen at the end of the school year, and that's an autopsy. It's too far away and behind to make a difference. And too often that data is also used to punish administration, and it shouldn't be used to do that, right? It should be used to support them, to coach them, to identify relative strength and weaknesses and target some things. Because even though it's biased, it certainly is biased, it's the pattern of these things that we can look at to say, you know, why are people feeling this way? And sometimes it's just misperception. Right. And you didn't mean to communicate that way, like you just said. Right. And if a bunch of people are saying it, say, hey, you know, sorry about the meeting the other day. That wasn't my intent. I was trying to create a sense of urgency. And I understand you guys feel afraid. Don't, you know, that wasn't, don't worry about it. We're going to do this. Or some people don't know the why behind something. And imagine them being upset and you get to the end of the year and there was a simple solution for it. This gives them an outlet to do it. But the secret to that stuff, to being useful, number one, to your point that you start off with, we got to have a good relationship. If people are, a measure of your leadership is people feeling comfortable to give you feedback about your leadership, right? Whether it's corrective or not, right? So that's one of the measures. But these kind of survey type piece of data, I would strongly recommend they're anonymous. They go to a third party like the coach who aggregates and summarizes the data to be the coach of the administrator in this case, right? And of course, it should be the same way for teachers. Students should have social validity, and there's good research to support that. And that goes out to the teachers' coaches because we want to make sure they feel safe, cared for, that they feel like they're learning, they're engaged in all these things, and that data never be used to punish, only to coach to say, here's what's going well. Do it. And then you also start to get norms and stuff. They realize that, hey, it's like the stock market. It fluctuates. We know it's going to go down in October when people are stressed. It's going to go down again in, like, you know, March, you know, as testing in May. All this stuff happens, man. But checking with people for feedback from them, because we want to make sure feedback's reciprocal, is really an important piece of the puzzle that gets forgotten about.
Absolutely.
Okay, what do you got next for us?
All right, the last one is add value. And the question that goes along with that is, what am I doing to make the situation better? And again, I ask this of myself, but I will also use that with my team. So if they come to me with a problem, I'm also going, it allows for a richer discussion, and it builds self-efficacy. You know, we want to build up people's self-efficacy, the belief that they have power over their environment and their situation. And that question really gets into it.
I boy, do I like that. And also it keeps people from being what we call prompt dependent. Going back to the GPS analogy, if you, everybody listening to this has used the GPS to go to the same place over and over and over again. You
are, I do.
Yeah, same thing, man. We are prompt dependent. We're waiting for people to tell, we're waiting for this thing to tell you where to go because we don't have to think for ourselves. And gosh, I think that school leadership might be the most challenging leadership position in the country because the management ratios are so far off. Policies are very difficult to do. Like, the demands just keep getting layered and layered and layered. And so I have so much good in my book. I talk about this. I think good school leaders and good classroom leaders, teachers, they need to be good classroom leaders, right? The good ones, they're amazing. These are some of the best leaders that we have to offer in the world because it is very challenging to lead under those conditions with the tool. You're kind of given a spoon. You got to dig yourself out and you got to have, it can be done, but you got to have all cylinders firing, man. You got to be very good at the things that you do. And so I have massive respect for good classroom leaders and good school leaders. It really is a challenging job, but it can be done. It can be done. So, all right. Tell me, I drifted off there for a second. The last point you made was, because I want to double down on the point. What was the last point you made?
I talked about self-efficacy and asking, what can I do to add value?
Yeah, it was about, and about the prompt dependency. And so good leaders build more leaders around them. And they do that by asking questions. Coming back to what we said earlier about the students, you know, about teachers asking good questions, right? We want people to be able to better assess, problem solve, make decisions, and take actions in our absence. And I love that you want them to come solution focused, right? How do I add value to this? Because that sets the tone for they already know when they come in that you're going to ask that question instead of being a got you. They're going to come with some solutions or reflect on their own behavior and the impact of it. And you can ask some more questions. And that's part of a culture that you're establishing by embedding these values. I like this so much. How long now have you been shifted to this new position? Because I would like to say, I'm sure that from this position, you can start to embed these values as a leader into the environment where they're at. What changes have you seen as a result of it? And I don't remember, I remember a while back you were getting, there was somebody, you might have already talked about him, one of your mentors there that you felt very highly about, and you were bringing a toolbox of OBM and that you wanted to share, right? So you can collectively, because you had the right person that was above you, which is wonderful, because you felt supported there. I remember that. What are the big changes that you think that you've made? We'll keep it aligned with feedback in the environments that you're supporting. And I'm sure it's not perfect wherever it's at, because it never is perfect. But where was it, and where do you see it now? Like, you know, in terms of what people are doing and what results are you seeing as a result of that?
Sure. You know, I think a really concrete example would be one of my programs involves a residential component. So for girls that are, you know, adjudicated. And so there's a residential team and there's a school team. And they really work in separate silos. And historically, there was always kind of tension in between the school team and the residential team. People were blaming each other and nobody was leveraging separate realities and everybody was pointing the finger at each other. So, me and members of the leadership team on the residential side were like, okay, we really need to work on this, and started talking about the leadership behaviors and embedding it into our work. And, you know, whenever somebody would come to me with, you know, a complaint of this person did that, I'm like, okay. Well, let's leverage separate realities. What do they have going on that maybe influence their behavior?
Great question. Great prompt too, right? So you're really prompting perspective taking.
Yeah, I know. We had a new paraprofessional come in, and a lot of the people, you know, on the residential side have been there forever, and they get it. You know, they come with so much historical knowledge that you kind of just take for granted at this point. So a lot of people come to me saying, hey, you know, this new paraprofessional, she put on YouTube videos. She let the kids lay on the floor. She did X, Y, and Z. And, you know, it's a problem. I'm like, okay. Well, first of all, I asked, well, what did you do to make the situation better? A lot of times the original answer would be, I'm bringing it to you. I'm like, okay, well, what could you do to make the situation better? And, you know, we will kind of come up with some problem-solving ideas, and I will probably coach them through how to give the new paraprofessional some advice or feedback. And then also really leveraging, you know, that separate reality and say, hey, she's new. She hasn't been in this environment before. And I think there's a lot of information that we do take for granted. You know that the YouTube videos, because you've been through it, gets out of hand. All of a sudden, you go from a lot of our kids, you give them an inch, they take a mile, and they need very strict limits. That's how they succeed and they flourish. And so you've had that experience. You've been through it where you've tried YouTube videos and have seen it deteriorate into complete chaos. And so because you've had that experience, you know how to go about it. Do you think this new paraprofessional has had that experience yet to learn that? And they're like, oh, no. I'm like, yeah, you know, it's really not common knowledge to know that YouTube videos is going to turn into chaos. You know, so either they can experience it for themselves, or, you know, you could say, hey, you know, I've had this experience and I wanted to let you know.
I love this. This is I have a saying, and I think it's important. It's exactly what you're doing here. I say if they knew better, they would do better, right? But we talk about what knowing is. Like people say, well, I told them. That's not knowing. Knowing is having self-efficacy. I believe I can accomplish the task. I can do this thing. Knowing is response efficacy. I believe if I do this thing, it's going to produce this outcome. Okay. So I know what to do. I know how to do it. I know that if I do it, that I will produce an outcome. And then it's valuing the outcome. Now, I believe that people value the outcome of not having behavior challenges, having good, you know, learning and students engage. I believe in that. I believe a lot of times that even if they've been told, like say, hey, here's how you do classroom management, for example, or here's how you teach, that they can actually engage in the task. What they don't believe is that they can produce that outcome. And I think this is the part where it's important for people to engage in what I like to call quick wins and getting them to do something that is small, right? So you don't change a whole classroom day. You change one transition. We've talked about this before. I remember in the past, right? If it's a school, you don't change the whole school day. You change the arrival time. And when we do this, people can engage in the behavior that's required. Of course, we got to make sure they have the knowledge and skills to do it. And there's a structure to it, whatever. If it's the students, they know the expectations. We have reinforcement set up, correction, working feedback, all that stuff. But we help them see by doing this, this is produces the outcome and they value it. And another one I use in the classroom is opportunities to respond, right? Managing response rates, getting teachers to use whiteboards with popsicle sticks, response cards, you know, all this stuff. Man, want to talk about an immediate, they're having a whole group instruction, immediate change in on-task behavior. It's incredible, right? The more students are engaged in an assignment, the less likely they're going to be, you know, disengaged. Well, they can't, it's incompatible, but engaging in disruptive behaviors. So that's something where people can align their behavior with the results. If they knew better, they would do better. Because, you know, as we've seen, there's no way that the stuff that we've both seen that teachers would do those things if they knew better, because it's making their job so much more challenging. And that's exactly what you set up with those good questions with that para. So, well, Jillian, this has been a lot of fun. I love talking about this stuff. I'd love to see that where you've gone, where you're going. And I'm very interested to see, you know, where you land. And I'd love to have you on again in the future to talk about some of the more of the approaches. I think the listeners are going to get a lot from this discussion on feedback. If somebody wanted to reach out to you, you know, what would be the best way? And we'll drop this stuff in the show notes as well.
Absolutely. So I think LinkedIn is probably the best way. I'm very active on LinkedIn. I'm always checking that. So that's a great option. And then my email address, people could always email me at bucciero.jillian@gmail.com. That's my personal email address. And I'm always checking that as well.
All right, Jillian. It's been a pleasure. Looking forward to having you on again.
Awesome. Thank you.
Traditionally, many crisis management systems have taken a what's wrong with you approach that begins as a person escalates when addressing behavioral issues. PCM, as a trauma-informed approach rooted in applied behavior analysis, shifts this perspective from what's wrong with you to what happened to you by having a complete picture of a person's situation in life, past and present. This approach is fundamental to applied behavior analysis and therefore PCM, as it seeks to determine the root causes of behavior based on both the current environment and the individual's history as a means of individualizing education, treatment, and support. For more about PCM, check out crisisintervention.com.